Pull up a chair. I want to take you somewhere hot and loud and a long way from home. Southern China, the tail end of 1941. The air smells like rice paddies and hot oil, and there's a row of fighter planes parked on a dirt strip with the meanest faces you ever saw painted on their noses. Rows of teeth, a wild red eye, like something out of a nightmare sitting there in the sun. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar. And today we're going to talk about a bunch of Americans who went to war for a country that wasn't theirs, flying an airplane everybody said couldn't win, months before their own nation ever fired a shot. The Flying Tigers. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the coffee hot this morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, the men in this story earned theirs the hard way. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's get into it. To understand the Tigers, you've got to understand one stubborn, half-deaf Louisiana man named Claire Chennault. Chennault was an Army airman in the 1930s, and he had ideas, loud ones. He believed pursuit planes, fighters, could be organized into a real defense that with good early warning and good tactics, you could stop a bomber force cold. The bomber generals of the day didn't want to hear it. The thinking back then was that the bomber would always get through, and here's this cotton farmer's son with a gravel voice and bad ears telling them they were wrong. They pushed him out. Medical retirement, 1937, partial deafness. They said Chennault took his pension and did something you and I would call slightly insane. He went to China. China was already at war. Japan had invaded, and the Chinese Air Force was a shambles, a few worn-out airplanes against a modern military machine. Chennault went over as an advisor to Chiang Kai-shek's government, and what he saw made his blood run cold. Japanese bombers coming over the cities more or less whenever they pleased. No real way to stop them. So Chennault started writing letters home, begging, really, he wanted airplanes, and he wanted American pilots to fly them. Now here's where it gets interesting. The United States was neutral, officially, on paper, we were not in this fight. You could not simply hand fighter planes and active duty pilots to a foreign government at war. That was a diplomatic powder keg. So they did it sideways, quietly, with a wink from the very top of the Roosevelt administration. A plan came together. A civilian company, a front really, would hire American pilots. These men would resign from the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps. On paper, they became employees of an outfit called the Central Aircraft Manufacturing Company. Civilians, mercenaries, if you want to be blunt about it. The American Volunteer Group, the AVG, the pay was good for the time. $600 a month for a pilot, more for a flight leader, and there was a bonus, an unofficial one that everybody understood. $500 for every Japanese airplane you destroyed. A bounty that tells you something about the kind of men who signed up. And the airplane they were given to do it in? Well, let's talk about the airplane, because this is a warbird show and I've been dying to get to it. The Curtiss P-40 in their case, an export version called the Tomahawk. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, the way an old pilot ought to be. The P-40 was not the best fighter of the Second World War, not even close. By the time the great dogfighters showed up, the P-51 Mustang, the P-47 Thunderbolt, the P-40 was already yesterday's news. It had an Allison engine that ran out of breath up high. Get it above 15,000 feet or so and it got sluggish, gasping, because it didn't have a proper supercharger for high altitude. It couldn't turn with a Japanese fighter. Not a chance, the nimble ones. The Nakajima and the Mitsubishi types the Tigers faced. Could turn inside a P-40 all day long and end up on your tail. So on paper this was a losing proposition. An obsolete airplane flown by a ragtag group of resigned officers defending a country that was already losing against the most experienced naval air arm on the planet. But Chennault, remember, was a tactician, and he understood something about that P-40 that turned all its weaknesses into a plan. The P-40 was heavy, it was rugged, built like a bank vault, with a big Allison up front, an armor plate, and self-sealing fuel tanks. And a heavy airplane pointed downhill is a very fast airplane. In a dive, that P-40 could run away from anything the Japanese had. It could take hits and keep flying, and it carried a punch, machine guns that could tear an enemy apart in a single pass. So Chennault told his pilots to throw out everything they thought they knew about dogfighting. Forget the turning fight. Forget the graceful duel of the First World War that everybody grew up dreaming about. You will never win that fight, he told them. And if you try it, you will die, instead. Dive. Come down from above, from out of the sun if you can. Pick one target, hit him hard in one fast pass, all guns hammering. And then keep right on going, straight down and away, and use that beautiful heavy airplane speed to climb back up and set up again. Never ever try to mix it up in a turning circle, hit and run, slash and dive. Two airplanes working together, always a pair. One watching the other's tail, he drilled it into them on the ground over and over with a big chalkboard and models and that gravel voice until they could see the whole fight in their heads before they ever left the dirt. And the other piece the bomber generals had laughed at back home, was the warning net. Chennault set up a web of spotters all across the Chinese countryside. Ordinary people, villagers, with telephones and radios, strung out for hundreds of miles. When Japanese formations lifted off and headed inland, word came down the line post to post, faster than the bombers themselves could fly. So by the time the enemy arrived, the Tigers weren't scrambling in a panic. They were already up, already high, already waiting in the sun with the altitude advantage, ready to roll in and dive. That's the whole trick, friends. That's the whole magic act. An outdated airplane used only for what it was good at, guided by information nobody else bothered to gather. Chennault took a losing hand and figured out exactly how to play it. Now, the teeth. You've all seen the picture even if you don't know the story. That shark mouth painted on the nose of the P-40, rows of white teeth, a red mouth, an eye up by the exhaust stacks. It might be the most famous piece of nose art in all of aviation, and here's the part that always makes me smile. The Tigers didn't invent it, they copied it. Somebody in the group saw a photograph in a magazine of British P-40s over in North Africa with shark mouths painted on, and the Brits had gotten the idea from the Germans before them. The Tigers looked at that long pointed nose of the P-40, that radiator scoop underneath that looked just like an open jaw, and said, "Well, that's perfect," and they painted their whole outfit that way. Funny thing is the name. They painted tiger sharks on the nose, but the newspapers back home started calling them the Flying Tigers. Sharks on the airplane, tigers in the headline, and the tiger name stuck so hard that Walt Disney's studio ended up designing them an official emblem, a little winged tiger jumping through a V for victory. But it was sharks on those cowlings the whole time. Let me put you in the cockpit for a second. It's before dawn, you've been rousted out of a cot in some primitive field in China or up in Burma, and you're cold, because it gets cold at altitude even when the ground is a furnace. The word came down the warning net an hour ago. They're coming. You climb up on that wing, slide into a cockpit that smells of hot metal and hydraulic fluid and the sweat of the last man who flew her. That big Allison up front kicks over with a bark and a shudder, a rough, throaty, uneven idle that smooths into a hard mechanical roar. You can't hear yourself think, you can feel it in your teeth. You claw for altitude, you and your wingman, spiraling up over the countryside, watching the sky go from gray to gold, and then you see them. A formation of bombers far below now because you got up high like Chennault taught you, little crosses crawling across the earth with their fighter escort stacked above, and you push over, nose down. The airspeed builds and builds until that heavy airplane is screaming, the wind howling over the canopy, the whole airframe trembling. You pick one, you put the sight on him, and at the last second you mash the trigger, and those guns light up the whole nose in a hammering shudder, and then you're through, you're past, you're diving away flat out before the escort even knows you were there. That was the Flying Tigers, not a duel. A knife fight in the dark over and done in seconds. They first went into combat right around the time of Pearl Harbor, December 1941, and in the months that followed, this little band of civilian pilots, never more than a few dozen airworthy fighters on any given day, flying an airplane the experts had written off, tore into the Japanese air forces over China and Burma, and did not stop. They defended the Burma Road, that lifeline of supplies snaking up into China. They defended Chinese cities that had known nothing but the terror of the bombers. And the kill numbers they claimed were staggering, hundreds of Japanese aircraft against a tiny handful of their own lost in combat. Now, historians will tell you rightly that wartime claims are always high in the confusion of a fight. Everybody knows that, but even when you shave the numbers down honestly, the ratio is astonishing. A pack of hit-and-run mercenaries and obsolete fighters running rings around a superior enemy through nothing but tactics, discipline, and that early warning net. And they did it in impossible conditions. No supply chain to speak of. They cannibalized wrecked airplanes for parts. A damaged P-40 was a parts bin for two others. They flew airplanes held together with patches and prayers off of dirt strips in monsoon weather, with malaria running through the camp and no relief coming. When a fighter was too shot up to fly, the ground crews, and God bless every wrench turner who ever lived, would work through the night by lantern light to have it ready again by dawn. The whole thing lasted less than a year as the AVG. In the summer of 1942, with America now fully in the war, the group was folded into the regular Army Air Forces. Chennault put his stars back on and stayed in China commanding air forces there for the rest of the war. Some of his volunteers signed back up into the military. Some had had enough and went home. But the legend was already made. Now here's what I want you to take away from all this, because it's bigger than the airplane. We love to talk about the great fighters, the Mustang, the Spitfire, the ones with the perfect lines and the perfect engines, and they earned every bit of the glory. But the P-40, the also-ran, the airplane that couldn't climb and couldn't turn, wrote one of the most remarkable chapters in the whole war. And it did it not because it was the best, but because one stubborn half-deaf man understood exactly what it could do and refused to ask it to do anything else. There's a lesson in that for every one of us who flies. You go to war or you go cross-country on a Saturday morning with the airplane you've got. Not the one in the magazine, the one on the ramp. And the pilot who knows his machine cold, who flies it for its strengths and respects its weaknesses and doesn't try to make it something it isn't, that pilot will beat the fellow with the fancier airplane and the sloppier head every single time. Chennault proved it with shark teeth and a chalkboard. There are still a handful of P-40s flying today, lovingly restored. And if you ever get to an air show and hear one start up, go stand by the fence and listen to that Allison rumble. Close your eyes. Think about a cold dawn over China and a young man far from home climbing into the sun. My thanks to the historical accounts of the American Volunteer Group and the recorded memories of Chennault's own pilots, along with the folks who keep these airplanes flying and the museums that keep their story straight. If you want to dig deeper, wander over to radiohangar.com when you get a chance. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the shiny side up and don't ever let anybody tell you your airplane can't do the job. It's usually the pilot they should be worried about. See you next time.